Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching a Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
This is it, Richard. We did it. We counted down. We're finishing up. 15-episode countdown, Game of Thrones.
We're at the end before the beginning of the new season, the last season, which is also an end.
We're, to quote another major thing that's ending this month, we're in the end game now. So here it is. We are here to discuss what we have decided between us is the most essential and important episode of Game of Thrones. It's season 6, episode 10, The Winds of Winter, written by Weiss and Benioff, directed by my favorite Game of Thrones director, Miguel Sapochnik. We will be chatting a little bit about, you know, we'll give out some awards, we'll chat about why the episode's important. We have an interview with composer Ramin Djawadi, who is responsible for like a lot of the power in the opening of this episode. But before we get to all that, let us just really quickly remind you, this is Sunday. The premiere of Game of Thrones drops tonight on HBO. If you want to read everything that we wrote about what happened on Game of Thrones tonight, you're going to want to go to vanityfair.com/thrones, enter promo code thrones. Make sure you are a subscriber. $7.50, whole year, digital print. VanityFair.com/thrones, promo code thrones, tote bag, all the access to all the content. We do not want a paywall between you and our Game of Thrones coverage this year. Richard, why do you think people should plunk down their hard-earned $7.50 for this Vanity Fair subscription?
Well, I feel like in the last episode, I sort of threatened, like, Dragonfire. And I don't want to do anything like that kind of menacing again, but I'm just going to say, Joanna and I have a lot of barrels full of a mysterious green substance that, you know, could do something bad if you don't subscribe to VF.
It could. Wow. So that's two episodes in a row where we've threatened to burn people if they don't give our employers money. So I'm sure we are going to be employees of the month. No problem. But anyway, yeah, go to vanityfair.com/thrones, promo code thrones. I guarantee you, you will get your money's worth for at the very least these next few weeks. But also, like, we have great stuff on our website all the time. We've got a great politics section, a great Hollywood section, some fun style stuff. So you're really going to want to go vf.com. All right.
We're going to have stuff from Cannes. I mean, you know, there's a lot.
I'm really excited for all your Cannes coverage, as I always am. And also, really quickly, if you want all of our Game of Thrones stuff distilled into a newsletter, we're doing a Thrones newsletter this year called the Westeros Update. So you can go to westerosupdate.com and drop your email in there to sign up. And it just means you'll get all the stuff delivered to your email inbox on Monday. And that, you know, that way you can just make sure you've caught everything. You don't have to click around. It'll just be right there for you. So westerosupdate.com for all the latest. Okay, here we go. my job that I've always set for myself in these episodes is to recap these episodes of Game of Thrones with 15 words or less. I've only got two words for you this week, Richard. It is boom, boom.
Boom, boom.
Boom, boom. That's it. That's this episode. Then we're going to roll to maybe the most obvious MVP that has ever obviously MVP'd in an episode of Game of Thrones, which is my pick for obvious MVP of this episode, Cersei Lannister. Richard, who do you got?
Mine is the High Sparrow. No, I'm kidding. It's Cersei. Of course it's Cersei.
Obviously it's Cersei.
She's the MVP of the whole series because of this episode.
Can I share the what you texted me last night when you were watching this?
Yes, please.
Richard was like, I've watched Cersei blow up the set 500 times, except 500 times, but I'm still cackling like a maniac watching it this time. So good.
I remember the first time I watched it, I was just screaming at the TV, and now I'm laughing. It's just it's the most satisfying thing. And, you know, in large part because Sapochnik builds up to it so wonderfully with the music and, you know, just the momentum. It's just one of the best payoffs in recent TV memory.
I love it. And, you know, even though, characters we love, I mean, I love Marjorie. So, you know, R.I.P. Marjorie Tyrell. But this is it for her. Okay, so then we want to do our sneaky MVP. I'm going to give it to King Tommen Baratheon, first of his name, as far as I'm concerned, for he kind of went out like a chump, but he went out in one of the most memorable deaths, oddly. And this isn't just for Tommen, but, it's for the directing decision, whether it was Mikael's choice or in the script, I don't know, but, the camera just basically you see Tommen, he's got his crown on. He's in shot and he's framed by the window that looks out on King's Landing. And then he just walks out of frame. You can hear him set his crown down out of frame. And then he just walks back in frame and goes out of the window, but the camera never moves. And it's just it's such a stunning. And then he just sort of dead drops, you know, it's just like a,
right.
It's not a leap. It's just a fall. And it's incredible. I don't think it's going to happen that way in the books, only because Tommen is much younger in the books. So I really don't think we're going to have this little toddler. And I don't know if this sept explosion happens. We do know that, in the books, Cersei burns the Tower of the Hands. She burns something in the books, but I don't know if all of this is going to happen. And we'll talk about that. If this is a big departure from the book, why that feels important to the identity of the series at this point. Who is your sneaky MVP of this episode, Richard?
I don't know his name, but that sneaky little kid who gets Lancel down into the crypt or whatever. I just love how his little plan worked so well.
Yes, I love that. So then this is the part of the episode where we do impressions of actors on the show. It's been our most popular bit because people are like, wow, guys, your impressions are dead on. We love when you do those. Anyway, so we're going to pick a line from the episode, do an impression. Here's mine. Goes like this. Let the grown women talk, which is the Bamf of them all, Olenna Tyrell, back from the dead. The last time we talked, she was dead on the show, but hey, she's back. Yay, Olenna Tyrell, shit-talking the Sand Snakes is a pretty delicious part of this episode. What do you got, Richard?
Mine is simple. It's just, there's something wrong. I love Natalie Dormer as her mounting fear, and she's the only one who's like, guys, this is not good. This is not good. It's so well done. It's a great way for her to go out.
Yeah, I was said this on Twitter when I rewatched it recently that I actually almost wish she had gotten, you know, because Marjorie's this political player all the way through. She rarely loses her cool. She's always scheming. Even this whole season where she has to pretend that she gives a shit about religion. She has to wear these dowdy dresses and her hair is super plain, and she hates all of it, I'm sure, because she'd rather be showing off her midriff and flirting and whatever. But she's done all of it dutifully in order to win the game. And then she's this thing is happening, and I just wish we had seen her go bananas in that scene almost. Do you know what I mean? Fully let the mask slip and really go for it. But what she's given to Natalie Dormer, great throughout the series. So what she's given to do in that episode, I mean, that scene is just, It's good.
Yeah, when she says something like "fuck the gods" or whatever, we have to leave, you know. And she and like the people are like, "Huh?" And it's like, no, she's been pretending this whole time, you idiots. Like, just,
The high sparrow's like, what now?" She's like, "Old man, get the fuck out of my way." All right. Then this is a tough part because this is the best dressed. And actually, what happened in season six. And I think we talked about this earlier. What happened in season six is costume designer Michelle Clapton like left for a bit and someone else took over. And with all due respect to that person, they just did not have the same eye for Game of Thrones as Michelle Clapton does. So you get weird stuff like Missandei wearing palazzo pants and Grey Worm wearing like a deep V and stuff like that. It just looks like kind of wrong. But she is back in this episode, and this episode opens with a dressing montage and every detail. You like, this is like the glam, let's show off the cuffs and the collars and the hems and the buttons and the rings and the everything. Like, it's just, it's a fashion episode. But the winner has to be Cersei sitting on the throne at the end, because she's wearing this dress that Michelle Clapton designed to look like Tywin Lannister's armor. Our colleague Julie Miller has a great article up about that she did about it like a couple years ago whenever this aired, that's up on our website, where she talks, Michelle Clapton talks about all the detailing that she did to mimic Tywin's armor. And it's really Cersei being like, fuck you, I'm in charge. What do you got for me on this front, Richard?
Well, it's hard to argue against that. I mean, I think that this is the beginning of a new look for Cersei. She's really finally, I mean, she's really fully rocking the short hair. And do we know if she, is she staying with short hair in the last season?
Yeah, this is it. This is it for her.
So she's found her look. I love that when you find what works for you, you run with it.
Yeah.
That said, as a runner up, any episode with Elena Tyrell in it, you gotta give it up for her clothing too.
It's absolutely, yeah, she goes into mourning, and so her like usual like blues or whatever, like it's the same outfit that she always wears but black.
Mm-hmm.
So good. All right, and then what's the last thing we gotta do here? We gotta do a ship. Okay, so here's my deal. I'm still shipping. This is when we pick like two characters or a character and an inanimate object, whatever it might be, that we like really wish would get together. I'm still shipping Marjorie and Tommen. I want those two crazy kids to work it out. So like Marjorie's ash pile and Tommen's splatted corpse, like if those two things, may they forever find each
Kinky.
Other somewhere. what do you got?
Can I unship something? Meaning I want to unship the poor guy in King's Landing and that big fucking bell that falls on him. He wasn't doing anything wrong.
He was just walking here.
The episode makes careful effort to, like, we see him getting hit. There's, like, a smear of red. I mean, it's quick, but it's just like, oh, man, that's cruel.
I always took that as, like, a definite, like, it feels like a different reference to the Shame Bell, right? It's, like, like a callback, you know, it bounces through the same street, basically. So it's a callback to, you know, the last time a significant bell went down the street, Cersei was getting fucked over. This is her revenge. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess maybe let's assume that that guy who got squished was one of the people yelling at her, throwing things
at
her. So
spit on her or something, so. All right, so let's zoom through some things that weren't the boom boom. Well, no, actually, let's start with the boom boom. The reason why this episode is so important is not just because the set blows up, which is like a big spectacular thing, but the opening of this episode is like some of the best, like maybe the best 10 minutes of TV ever. I don't know. It's, I don't want to overstate it. It's incredible. Like the, We talk so much in these latter episodes about Game of Thrones feeling in a rush, Game of Thrones feeling like it needs to finish, stuff like that. And here it's like, you know what? We're going to take our time. And a lot of this is in the script. Like, you know, credit to Miguel Sapochnik, credit to the score of Ramin Djawadi, but credit also to Weiss and Benioff for, like, this is in the script. This, like, slow montage, everyone getting ready. The score is different than we've ever heard it before because there's piano on it. We've never heard that before. So it sounds different. This is one of my favorite pieces of music that Ramin Djawadi composed. And then we just see everyone getting ready. And there's even, like, a little bit of humor. Like, you see Cersei getting ready. She looks amazing. Tommen looks amazing. And then you see, like, the High Sparrow put a, like, a grubby hand through a grubby sleeve. You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. You know, even that guy and Picel. I don't know. It's a whole thing. Anyway, what do you think of this opening, Richard?
Yeah, I think it's really well done. I mean, I think it is a big departure stylistically for the show.
Yeah.
And at the time, I remember being like watching it in real time and looking on Twitter and tweeting myself and just being like, huh, like Game of Thrones is doing montages now. That's kind of weird, you know? And I think The Leftovers was on, not, it wasn't on at the same time, but recently a season had been on or was about to be. And I think there was some comparisons to that, but like, I like when this show, especially in a later season, while advancing the plot in the process, you know, does a little artistry, plays with form, plays with soundscape. You know, I think that's really cool. And to do this big thing at the beginning of an episode, to just throw us in, I think that's a really cool subversion of the, like, big thing at the end kind of style of the show. You know, it feels daring and exciting and is a major development past the text of the books that I think really works and is in keeping with character and a lot of foreshadowing that's been done, you know, because Martin spends a lot of time just kind of hinting at about wildfire, and you're like, something really big beyond the sea battle is going to go on with that wildfire, because they keep mentioning how much of it is under the Sept, you know. So I just think it delivers beautifully and is a hell of a way to open an episode of television.
Oh, so good. And I agree with you. It's like when we interviewed Fabian Wagner, one of the DPs for the show, he was talking about like you don't do a lot camera wise stylistically with Game of Thrones. He's like, it's a fairly standard shot show. You know, it's like over the shoulder, you know, like 1-2s, like you don't do canted angles or like, you know, that kind of style is not something Thrones does. And it doesn't. Yeah, it just rarely departs from its structure, which is not a knock on it, but like when it does, then you sit up and pay attention. So when it takes the time to do this, which just feels like it belongs in a different show entirely, it's like you're riveted. And not only that, it does that. It feels artistically great. It feels thematically great. And then it is efficient for what they need to do, which is start knocking players off the board. Like, this is something that Game of Thrones just does from, you know, season 6 on out, is let's clear the decks for the end, you know? And so season 7, I think, does it a little more clumsily when you've got like, oh, all the Sand Snakes are dead. Or they did it clumsily when they're like, let's kill off Dorne, or like, you know, whatever. Like, I meant in earlier in season 6 when like Alaria and Tyene just like kill the leadership in Dorne and it's done. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like there's certain times where you're like, I see what you're doing. It doesn't feel good. I can see the hinges of the plot here. But this, where it's just like, okay, Loras, Margaery, High Sparrow, Lancel, Picel, like, you know, Mace, Kevin Lannister, cousin, like, don't forget Uncle Kevin Lannister, like, all this sort of stuff. Like, it's just in one fell swoop, and in a way that, you know, it's not just all burning. You've got the, like, the little sparrow stabbing Picel, which is so good, and you've got Lancel, and that whole, like, Lancel slowly crawling towards the candle. Like,
oh, it's so good.
So good. So, yeah. Guess what?
Yeah,
it's good.
It's... I had one thing. It's funny. I was thinking about how it's kind of like a great season 5 episode of Buffy the Body.
Yeah.
Where you're like, what the hell is this doing? I've never seen the show look or sound like this, or not sound like this in Buffy's case, because there's no music. But it's exciting and it's fun. And they don't really return to this kind of artistic daring, I don't think, going forward. Not in the same way. But I love it as a kind of standalone episode. And also the thing you just mentioned, Kevin Lannister, and that like rang a bell in my head. It doesn't he kind of reveal to actually be some sort of a significant character at the end of the last book?
He dies
at the end of the last book.
Yeah, Qyburn shows up. Varys shows up and shoots him with a crossbow. Yeah,
that's right. Okay.
But yeah, so all of that happens, and that's just part of this episode. But it, you know, and Tommen obviously off the board, you know, like, and the Septa, I guess, off the board. All right, so that's all that happens there at King's Landing until like the very end of the episode. Jaime comes back, and Cersei is crowned herself queen. She's like, you know, fuck the line of succession, fuck all of that. I'm taking it. It's mine. You know, because she spends like basically, you know, she's queen. Robert dies, she spends the next few seasons like scrambling to get back that power. You know what I mean? Like, it's, and Marjorie is the source of a lot of that tension for her with Joffrey and with Tommen, where she's just like, she sees Marjorie as a political player and she's like, I will not be replaced. Like, I had sex with Robert Baratheon far too many times in my life to like lose this amount of power that I've earned for myself. It reminds me of, a movie that I loved, which is Natalie Portman and Jackie, which we talk about on Little Gold Men often, I think, but like, that movie contextualized Jacqueline Onassis in a way that I never understood, which is like, she had ambitions. She strove. Then she became the queen of America and it was like taken from her. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Her like, mm-hmm. her queendom. It's like, it's such a fascinating film for what it reveals there. Cersei is like more transparent in her ambition for power, but like, this is her just being like, you know what? I'm going to stop playing by the rules, which was like me trying to subtly influence my sons and just like, it's me. It's me now. Deal with it. Here we go. You know?
Yeah, totally. And it feels, despite Cersei being something of a villain, it feels completely triumphant.
Yeah, because, you know, she got really horribly abused. You know, for all of her sins, like the Walk of Atonement, like that nobody deserves that. So, yeah. All right, so let's just hop through a few of the things that happened this episode. So, I mean, like, I think to recap what we both said, you know, not to just gush some more, but just to say, like, because of this, feels like the show feeling itself independent of the books in a way, in a very successful way, in a way that feels important for this period of time when it's no longer an adaption show. It's a we're our own thing show, you know? We've got Sam and Gilly arrive at Old Town. Old Town is sexist and makes Gilly wait outside. Sam gets to see the library. It feels like a nice try, and this is like a nice uplifting sort of ending for a few characters. And so for Sam to like have this Old Town moment, see all these books, this is what he's been striving for. It doesn't really last long, and like honestly, the Old Town plot feels like they sent him there because George R. R. Martin sent him there, but like really they like got him back out of there kind of as quickly as they possibly could. With like he cured Grayscale, and that's about it. And then we've got Arya Stark returning to Westeros, which is huge, and having her revenge on House Frey. What did you think of this, like, Arya assassination thing?
Oh, I think it's also really well done. You know, it's satisfying. We get to see Frey do one last kind of bit of, you know, grotesquery. It's the payoff for all of the many, you know, episodes where Arya's been off, you know, training and not in Westeros, and, you know, the show wasn't spinning its wheels with her, I don't think, but, like, it's nice to see the sort of results of all that.
Absolutely. We get a similar triumph for Jon in that he's declared King of the North. So, you know, it's like Arya's on the rise. I mean, it's dark that she's like knocking names off her list, but like Arya's getting what she wants. Sam's getting what he wants. Jon's getting what he wants. Well, he doesn't really care about being King of the North, but like, you know, he's getting the house to rally behind him. And this feels like, you know, and Bran and Meera are coming home. They're getting close to the wall. And so, you know, something that we've had to reckon with as we rewatch this is like the fact that the season 5 is the low point for everyone. And then pretty quickly in season 6, they're like, what if some wins though? You know? So like, let's go back on the up and up. Sansa and Jon are back in Winterfell. Arya's back home. And then the big thing, of course, two big things. One, we get like the quote unquote reveal of Jon Snow's parentage, even though most people knew what that was all about. But like in the flashback form, we get the sort of confirmation that Jon Snow is not Ned Stark's bastard, but rather Lyanna Stark's son, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's a really big deal because it, you know, yes, everyone sort of knew it, but like it is the show confirming something that as of yet, George R. R. Martin has not told us.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that that's, and I think it's well done. I know that, you know, we talked earlier in an earlier episode about liking the Bran sort of astral traveling stuff. And I think it's done well.
Yeah, it's a hard task for them to get casual viewers to understand even who Lyanna Stark is. You know what I mean? Right. Like, that's so tough. And so I think they do it really well. It feels very clear. And yeah, so then all of that happens. And then, of course, there's this like huge gathering of forces. You've got the Ironborn have pledged to Team Daenerys. You've got the Dornish. You've got the Tyrells, you've got Varys, you've got Tyrion, you've got the Dothraki are on boats, even though they hate boats. And then you've got this like crazy final shot, where I think, Ramin Djawadi like combined five different themes to like one mega theme. And you just see this incredible force and three dragons and Daenerys at the prow of the ship going home. Like, this is what we've been waiting six seasons for. Daenerys comes back to Westeros. And, yeah, it's just, I love this episode. I think it's so good.
The chickens are coming to roost. You know, Arya's back. Dany's coming back. Cersei's back on the throne. There's a Stark as the king of the North again. You know, it's just all sort of like resettling after a lot of tumult. And I think that kind of, even if we're not 100% aware of that, like, or conscious of that, like, there's a subconscious reaction to things kind of reordering to a familiar shape.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, it's not that like I love it because everyone feels like they're winning, because like, that's, you know, I don't need that for a good episode of Game of Thrones. You know, like, I love the Red Wedding, I love Baelor, I love these things that are super well done but also really hard to watch. Hard Home is so good, even though Jon like really fully loses that particular skirmish. So it's not that I need like a happy ending for everyone. I just think like this is such a good example of a thematic, well-earned moment for all these people. And once again, just the show really leaning into its own power, just like much like Cersei's like, fuck you, I'm in charge. This really feels like the show saying like, fuck you, we're in charge. Not in a shitty way, but just sort of like, you know, this is it. This is us. We got this. And like, our, you know, Richard, you and I, our mileage may vary on season 7, whether or not they did actually got this, but you know, it's, it's something that it's a real high point creatively for the showrunners independent of the book. So that's why it's not my favorite episode of Game of Thrones, but it feels like the most important episode for that reason.
Yeah, it's a pretty bold assertion of several things, you know, and it's done successfully. So, I think it doesn't represent, yeah, my favorite storylines in Game of Thrones or anything, but like, it's the most the show is ever the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. And, it's really, really tremendous. All right. Is there anything else we want to say about this episode?
Just boom, boom.
Boom, boom it is. All right. So like, stay tuned for our, interview with composer Ramin Djawadi.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
I
Ramin Djawadi, thank you so much for joining us. We wanted to talk about The Winds of Winter to start off, this incredible opening music of the episode. It begins with a lot of silence and these bells. And I was wondering if you could talk about the bells that kick off this, the Light of the Seven piece.
That whole scene is a very interesting scene. It's a very long scene. There's not a lot of dialogue. And normally when I work on the show, I work in sequential order, meaning I start with episode one and work my way through. However, in that particular, in the season six, when I met with David and Dan, they said, look, I mean, we have this scene coming up in episode 10 we want you to have a look at. And then the whole discussion about we need a different theme, what about different instrumentation started up, and then the idea of the piano came up. And yeah, we just felt that a different instrument could really already trigger something for the viewer. And the piano was interesting because in six seasons of Game of Thrones music, we had never really used the piano as an instrument. It was just not part of the sound palette for the show. And so we started experimenting with the piano. We felt that could be an interesting thing. So not only is it a new theme, but also a new instrument itself. So and like you said, with the space in the beginning, that when that piano plays and these arpeggiated chords, and then there's these long gaps, and it just raises the question right away of, you know, what's going on here, and it slowly unravels throughout the scene. I think the scene is, I forgot now, 7 minutes long or 9 minutes long, so it's a very long piece that has to build over time.
And when that piece, you knew you were creating something different, something somewhat special, but when that piece went over the way it did, when there was such a huge reaction, not just to the sequence, but to the music itself, did that take you by surprise?
For sure. I mean, it always, you know, any response takes me by surprise because I never really think about that aspect. You know, I always try to do what we feel is best for the scene. And, you know, just, so it was... It was an experiment that it was great to see that it paid off because, again, this idea of this new instrument coming out of nowhere. And I have to be honest, we even got cold feet at some point, and we thought, are we taking it too far with the piano? So I actually tried the same piece with different instrumentation, with harp, celeste, which is a similar kind of... the notes kind of have a similar sound where it sustains, you know, it has an attack and then it sustains. But we always came back to the piano, and we just felt that that was the right approach. So, yeah, there was no way of knowing how the audience would pick up on that and how they would react. But it was incredible to see that it was so well received and liked. It was really, really great.
I was so amazed when I was digging back through some of the, you know, information about the music you've written over the seasons, to discover certain things like the fact that the first time we hear, The Reigns of Castamere, I believe, is when Tyrion is whistling part of it at the very first episode of the second season. So when you do stuff like that, when you seed in themes that are going to be more important later, like when Dan and David talked to you about writing The Reigns of Castamere, the music for that, did they lay out the entire significance of that piece for you?
Exactly. That's a perfect example. I mean, I wrote Reigns of Castamere in between seasons. I didn't even have any footage. And funny enough, I have to admit, when I started the show, I had not read the books, and I still haven't read them. My plan is to read them once the show is over. So I did not know about the Red Wedding and everything. And so they've always been incredible in guiding me and telling me, okay, this is going to end up here. And so when they were shooting season two, they called me up and said, here are some lyrics from the books. And we want you to write this melody that will become the Lannister theme. And we will start planting this new theme in season two, and that ultimately will lead them to the Red Wedding. And when that melody plays at the wedding, the audience, you know, we will know this is the Lannister theme. It doesn't belong in this place. There's something off. And so, yeah, they're really incredible in guiding me along this very complex storytelling. And music is obviously a big part of the storytelling, so it's very important that the way we manipulate the themes and write the music, it really can put the viewer in the right direction or the wrong direction. You know, it's part of the storytelling. It's very important in this show.
Can you think of an example? Has there ever been a theme that you've written that you and David have collaborated on, but when you laid it over the footage, you were just like, nope, this isn't right, and let's go back to the drawing board on this one?
Yeah, one that comes to mind was actually one of the more recent one, which was the Danny and John love theme in season 7. I actually had written a different melody, and it just didn't feel right. And the tricky part about that melody was that we needed to establish it early, but without kind of giving their romance away right away. So it had to be a theme that can play more neutral and then really open up and really become romantic later on. And the first version that I'd written, it just didn't feel right. And actually, interestingly, many times before I even present something to David and Anna, I sometimes write something and then even just trash it before I even play it to them. So I go through that process myself. But yeah, with this particular theme, we just said, you know, let's try something else. And I'm glad we did, because the theme we now ended up with is definitely, I feel like, is the right choice.
Oh, it's a great theme. Will you ever release those drafts of the John and Denny theme that might have been, or other versions?
Probably not. In fact, I tend to actually destroy things when I don't use them. I sometimes destroy them, so I would have to dig up if I still have it or not.
I was just discussing recently the episode, the season 3 episode Kiss by Fire. I was talking to Brian Cogman about it, and what was funny is he was rewatching it and he said, this is the first time I ever noticed that the Greyjoy theme plays when Rob beheads Karstark or something like that. When these little motifs come up in an episode, like what kind of discussions do you have around that? Like, you know, I'm not going to ask you to remember necessarily something you scored many, many years ago, but like if a tiny leitmotif of a house comes up playing over maybe a different character, a character who doesn't belong to that house. What do you feel like Dan and David are trying, or you are trying to accomplish there?
We really try to link up themes with plots and characters and action. So there's definitely crossover sometimes. So I think with this particular scene, I think it's just because from season 2, there was the, was it not season 2? I think
The Theon beheading.
That's when we got That's when we had the Greyjoy theme, and so that same kind of beheading event, I guess you can say, we felt it would be a good idea to draw from that from season 2, just to show like a similar kind of the rage and the behavior, and then just the actions of what's happening on screen. So it's those are little fun things you can do with the music where you cross over like that.
Yeah, musicologists must have a little leg up on the rest of us in terms of connecting some of the themes. I'm sometimes bad at picking out the little motifs that you put in there. There is one theme that I believe it's called The Old Gods and the New, that sort of started associated with Catelyn Stark and then became associated with Brienne. You know, I believe that's correct. So when a theme hops a character like that, are you trying to make connective tissue between two characters? Or is it like, I really love this particular theme, Catelyn is no longer here, let's give this to Brienne instead? Or you know, is it practical or thematic or both?
It can be a little bit of both. I mean, we always try to really have it make sense. Like we had this other theme, for example, what we call the conspiracy theme, and then it kind of ended up becoming the Littlefinger theme, just because he was always the one in the background pulling the strings.
Right.
But initially, it really kind of started out more as an overall, whenever there was something that felt like, oh, a conspiracy or something that's, you know, off or cheating or, you know, lying, then that would be the appropriate theme. But it really then became Littlefinger's theme, because he was, many times, he was the one behind it. So yeah, it sometimes can jump, but we always try to have a reason for that.
One thing that I read that I thought was so interesting is that you, when you think about composing music, you think in terms of color.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I'm very inspired by visuals, and it's this phenomena for me when I write. The colors transfer into notes to me, and it's very hard to describe because there's so many different colors, and obviously then I combine. It's like painting to me. and I can't paint, so I guess I use music to paint with colors. So it's where it comes from, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I thought when I was a kid, I learned the notes on the piano they had colors on them, but I actually looked up my parents' house. I found one of the original books that I learned from with the colors in it, and those colors don't match what I see the notes in, so I'm not sure where it comes from. but it's definitely, it's always there. Yeah, it's always there.
Well, when you were talking about it in the past, you said something about how the North of the Wall has a great blue tone and Daenerys in the Desert has a yellow tone. Is there a challenge in these final seasons when everyone's in the similar place and it's winter all the time and everything's kind of bluey gray? Does that challenge you in terms of creating those differences in tone musically?
No, not really. First of all, they're established, and then it really kind of goes beyond the location too, because it's even the characters, the costumes and everything, like Melisandre with the red dress, or Daenerys in one season had a blue dress. You know, it's even those details within, you know, it's not just the overall like blue tone of the north, you know, with the snow and everything and the ice. It's really everything around it too. And there's, in the show, there's so much color. It all triggers something. So yeah, there's always, I feel like there's always something I draw from.
Can you think of the theme that was the hardest for you to crack? Was it this John and Danny theme from season 7, or is there another one that proved more difficult for you?
That was definitely one of them. And another one might have been actually the Daenerys theme itself, because this was also something that I heavily relied on David and Dan, because when I started the show, I'd only seen the first two episodes, and I couldn't tell, you know, what would become out of Daenerys. I just thought she's this, you know, I just couldn't see that she would become this powerful. And so David and Dan said, like, no, Ramin, whatever you do for her, we got to be able to make it big eventually, because, you know, the dragons and this. And so they told me, and then I thought, okay, I gotta make sure that I can, whatever I write, it has to be that. So that took me a little bit to get right, because it just wasn't in front of me just yet.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, speaking of the Daenerys theme, it seems like one of the biggest crescendos for the show musically came at the end of season 6, this closing instrumentation that has the Daenerys theme, the Greyjoy theme, the Unsullied, the dragons, the main title, all sort of, you know, occupying the same space musically as Daenerys's armada comes to Westeros. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that is such an ambitious, I think it's such an ambitious thing to do, to put all those together? It all works musically. It doesn't sound like jangling or too busy. Do you think that's as ambitious as the show is ever going to get, or do you have something even more ambitious than that in store for us in season 8?
I think at the time it just felt like something that I just conceptually thought it could be fun to do. And just because it was the season finale, and like I said earlier, when we have character overlapping and plot overlapping, we have choices with themes, and usually we just go for one of them. However, just because this was the finale and it was just so exciting, I just thought, let me just try and see if I can figure this out. So does that mean we will always try and do that moving forward? I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's hard to top the main theme, which just has been covered in every conceivable way, in every conceivable style. But do you have like a pet favorite theme, whether it's the main theme or any other one that you've composed for Game of Thrones?
No, I probably would say it's the main theme. Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, just because it captures the overall show. I always get excited when we get to use it, because we don't use it that often.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to draw from it when we decide, okay, now let's plant a little bit of the main title theme in here. It's always fun.
Do you have you heard a cover version of it that, you know, particularly tickled your fancy, something that you were like, oh, I never thought I would hear a mariachi version of this, or something like that?
I mean, I've heard some crazy ones. I mean, there was one with that was done with digital hard drives. That was just insane.
Just like beeping.
It's like blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was really creative. I couldn't believe it. So it's amazing to see how creative people get out there.
And is there a theme that you feel like? I don't know how to say this exactly. Maybe like underrated, like a theme that you think people should go and take another listen to because you're especially proud of it and it didn't maybe stick out the way that you thought it might.
Actually, you know, there's one that comes to mind. It's I call the honor theme, which we've used when. Usually when people, like there's a scene when, I've forgotten where it was, like with Jamie and Brian, when like, I think she hands him a sword or he hands her a sword, like there's this, or when people give an oath and say, I will do this, like that, it's this honor. And we use that theme. So it doesn't get used that often, but it's actually a theme I really like and I like when it comes up.
Once again, I know we want to preserve the mystery and the secret for everyone, but is there anything you can say, even vaguely, thematically about the music in season 8 or anything that you can tell, viewers to sort of keep their ears open for, throughout the season?
I don't know how to, it's hard to answer, but I guess I can say it's definitely, it's been interesting to reuse or develop existing themes and write them for scenes as they, where they belong. But then also there will definitely be new material also that we have not heard yet before. So it'll be a little bit of both again. And that's something we've done every season where we develop existing themes, but then bring in something new. So we'll definitely, have it one more time for this last season as well. It's quite exciting, I have to say.
I imagine there's a lot of opportunity, especially in this final season, of blending various house themes because everyone is sort of coming together in this final season, and so the opportunity to hear what a certain house theme might sound laid over another house theme. Does that feel vague enough to address at all for the final season?
I guess what I can say is just that it's more than ever in this season is that we really have, because especially early on, we would sometimes discuss scenes and we would say, well, we can use this house theme or this theme. And then we would, make a decision. In this last season, definitely more than ever, we have many choices of which themes to play and what to do. So that's, you have to make a decision and then go with it. But yes, definitely there've been choices to make for sure.
Yeah. And the other question I wanted to ask you, and this is not, thankfully about season 8, so you can breathe easier, is, I've talked to some of the people who do sound on the show in the past, and they've discussed the way in which it can be a sort of back and forth in terms of the various sound laying over. I'm thinking specifically of the dragons, but like the various sounds of war, of dragons, or whatever it might be that has to go into the show, and how it might be sometimes competing for space with your score. What is that like, balancing those two aspects of the show?
Yeah, that's something that's definitely always in discussion, and it's just very hard to do simply for the fact that when we're in post, that those things happen at the same time. The sound gets finalized while I write the music, so many times it doesn't even come together until the very end with the final mix. But I feel like the show manages it really well, and what we try to do is, especially with specific scenes where it becomes obvious that there could be that there will be a collision between the two, like for example in the Battle of the Bastards, there was such a big battle, and obviously that's a ton of noise and action and swords and horses and everything. So there we always try to get to that early. If it's written, I will actually provide my demos to the sound department so they can kind of shape around that, and then it comes actually back to me. Then I sometimes get sounds from them that I can write to, and then and so it's just a little bit of a back and forth so that it gets balanced out, and then ultimately decisions have to be made on the final dub stage when really everything comes together, and then it's a give and take when you have to decide, okay, do we want music to push a bit more? Do we want music out? Many times I've written more music than what ends up in the show because of the sound effects that we just decide, okay, this is just clashing right now. Let's just take the music out. It doesn't need it. The sound is plenty full, and there's the music for 3 minutes or 4 minutes going, so let's just take it out. So those decisions many times get made at the end and really can't be made before.
Right.
So I usually try to overwrite, and then it's always better. It's always easier to mute than to go, oh, you know what? We need a piece of music here. We need something tomorrow. We haven't written anything.
So right.
It's usually the other way. It's the other way around.
Yeah. And Thrones, more than a lot of other shows and even films, I think feels comfortable in its silences. Like, it's a show that uses silence as well. And that's why one of the reasons I think why your score stands out so beautifully is that it's not, you know, every single frame there's a score. It's like it'll cut out, and then when it comes in, then we're paying attention because it feels meaningful.
Yeah, exactly. I absolutely agree. And like I said, many times we even in our early review of the episodes, we'll say, oh, let's have a piece of music here, and then later say, well, do we actually need it? And then we'll just take it out. And I'll be the first one to admit too, that's like, you know, it doesn't need it, you know, but if I say it before, then it sounds like I'm lazy and I don't want to write the piece. So I'd rather write it, and then we can take it out later.
And I'm trying to recall, there's a sort of, descending sound, that happens right before the dragons breathe fire. Is that a sound effect or a score? Sort of flourish.
No, that's score.
That's score,
That's a score flourish, and that's my version of when you go on the electric guitar and you just kind of slide your hand down. It's that kind of a, oh, here it comes, and here's the fire. So
yeah.
that's the Game of Thrones version of the sliding guitar.
when did you first use it? Do you remember?
Yeah, we used it the first time actually when the dragons spew fire. It's when Daenerys kind of turns it around and gets the Unsullied.
Right.
And that whole twist, and that's the first time when she says Dracarys, and then the dragons lose fire. That's the first time we use it. So we've had it since the very beginning.
And did Dan and David say, like, give me a slide down of guitar? What did they say to commission that piece?
I think that's just something I provided. That's something I just wrote and everybody was into it. That was something that was not specifically discussed. So that's another good example of how our collaboration works. We'll talk through a scene. They'll give specific points, but then they also give me a lot of freedom to walk in with stuff and then we tweak and, you know, see what works. So, but yeah, that was something that I had come up with.
I know you have certain fun instrument kind of rules or principles that you've stuck to. Like, you mentioned that the piano that you used in The Light of the Seven sticks out because you hadn't used piano or the organ there. And also this no flute rule because it sounds too much like, I don't know, the Lord of the Rings score or whatever it may be. Can we expect any new instruments that we haven't heard before in the final season?
I feel like at this point we've used them all. So I don't know if there's anything. I can't think of anything right now.
Okay.
Not sure.
Okay, and then the my last two questions are these. And thank you again for your time. Was the last piece of music that you wrote, or I guess I should ask, are you done writing the music for season 8?
There's definitely still some tweaking going on.
Okay.
Let me say it this way. Yeah, so it's not completely final.
Okay, but you're done with like the major, you know, the majority of the scoring is done. Was the last major piece of music you wrote, was that a final piece of the season, or just something that had to do with something that happened earlier in the season?
It's definitely in the later part of the season. I could say that, I guess.
Okay. And then, let's all be careful. And then I guess I'm just curious how it felt for you then, even though you're still doing some tweaking, how did it feel for you, Ramin Djawadi, to finish your last major piece of music for this project that has been such a big part of your life for so long?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, because it's been such an amazing ride, and it was, the whole season, actually, not even the last piece, but the whole season has been very emotional, and every theme I touch upon, I will go, wow, is this the last time I'm going to write this? I'm going to use this theme. I'm going to write this theme, and so it's been quite emotional for me, actually, I have to say. It's on the one hand, I'm just super excited for everybody to see this last season, but it's been I think the drop for me will be even more, I think, once the show is on air and then maybe off the air, because there's still right now the excitement of I can't wait for the world to see what's to come. But I think after that, I think it will really be the depression will set in, I think.
Oh, no. maybe silver lining will be a relief to not be one of very few people on the planet to know all these Game of Thrones secrets, to no longer be a secret keeper for Game of Thrones.
Definitely. I mean, I'm very good in keeping secrets. I'm a strong believer that people should, see it all when it's out there on the air. I think it'll be nice to actually be able to discuss how this show ended with everybody, because it'll just be fun to have these discussions and share with everybody their opinions and everything. So, yeah.
Okay. Indulge me one more question. And once again, if you can't answer it, that's fine. If you had one word to describe the last music we hear of the season, can you give us a word that you don't think will spoil the experience for people?
I'm not sure if I can, actually, because okay. I know people they dissect everything so much. I'd rather just let people be surprised.
Fair enough.
I'm
all
sorry.
Right. No. I appreciate it. Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you again so much for your time and all your work over the years. It's meant a lot to me and to a lot of people. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. My pleasure.
So that does it. That wraps up our rewatch. Now our rewatch has ended, Richard. We did it.
Yeah, I was little inside baseball. I was for our listeners, I was like a little bit reluctant to dive into a really watch intensive recappy kind of thing in the lead up to the new season, but I'm so happy you convinced me to. It has reminded me of my love for the show. It's rekindled my interest in the next season. I have watched more episodes than I was assigned for this thing,
which was
surprising for me. Enjoyed them. I've been tweeting a lot about the show, and it's been fun to kind of re-engage with people on that front. So yeah, I'm super excited for tonight's premiere.
Tonight's premiere. Yeah, this is dropping on Sunday, so let's pretend. Yes, tonight the show premieres. No, anyway, I feel the same way, actually. Like, I wanted to do this no matter what, because I cover Game of Thrones, so no matter what I wanted to do this, there was no one else I wanted to do it with. But also, I was also surprised. I think I've said this, that I feel reinvigorated. I'm glad we did this, where my original idea was, let's do every episode. And Richard and some of our bosses were like, Joanna, you're crazy. Which was probably the right reaction. But doing this, where we're like, these are high points, let's hop through the high points and really remember when this show was really at its best and when everything was firing on all cylinders. So I'm glad we did it. And we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep doing still watching through the season. We're still going to have
our great interviews, you know, knock on wood. And, you know, we're going to try to get those episodes to you as quickly as we can after the episode airs. We don't have screeners. We can't watch in advance. So, you know, we'll be doing our best. We're aiming for Mondays. And we will see what we can do. In the meantime, until I guess maybe tomorrow, Richard, where can people find you?
They can find me sitting on my couch watching Game of Fucking Thrones and being happy about it. And I'll be tweeting definitely at Rylaws, R-I-L-E-W-S, and we'll be writing stuff for VF.com. Joanna, where can people find you?
Crying? No, I mean, it's...
in a ball, weeping.
Maybe okay, really? I'll be more like Sam in season 7, which is when he's like cleaning the toilets and scraping the food and like everything looks really awful for him at the Citadel. But like, you just imagine me like Cersei sipping her wine on the balcony, envisioning, surveying her kingdom. I don't know. Imagine me that way. That won't be the reality, but imagine me that way. Or you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. Please do follow Richard during the episodes. When Richard live tweets something, it is a joy to behold. So you will enjoy this. He'll be traveling though a bit, so you know, we'll see what happens. But all right, this is it. We're in the end game now. Final 6 episodes of Game of Thrones. Let's do it.
See you tonight.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.